Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Women play an important role in Professor Barbara Winslow's life. Actually, feminism transformed her academically, personally, and politically. After graduating from Antioch College, Barbara moved to Seattle to attend graduate school at the University of Washington, where, in her words, she found her own political voice with the start of the women's movement there. She received her PhD and helped start the Women's Studies Department at the university. An historian, Barbara Winslow was the first professor of women's studies at Seattle Community College, where she taught from 1971 to 73. She was also an adjunct at Barnard, NYU, and several other schools in New York. And she's also taught the first women's studies class at New York City's infamous Rikers Island Prison. Barbara has been on the Brooklyn College faculty since 1997. 3 years later, she was appointed head of the Women's Studies program, a position she held until 2004. Professor Winslow is the founder and director of the Shirley Chisholm Project of Brooklyn Women's Activism, 1945 to the present, which began during her tenure as coordinator of the school's Women's Studies program. Winslow has written a book about the life of Shirley Chisholm and Brooklyn women's activism. Now, for those who don't know about Shirley Chisholm, a little background. A teacher, her passion for progress got her into politics. In 1968, she became the first African-American woman elected to Congress, representing Brooklyn's 12th Congressional District. In 1972, Chisholm launched an historic bid for the White House, becoming the first Black and first woman to seek the Democratic presidential nomination. In the 2004 documentary Unbought and Unbossed that traced her historic presidential bid, Chisholm, who didn't win a single primary, said, quote, "She ran for office in spite of the hopeless odds to demonstrate sheer will and refusal to accept the status quo." Barbara, I'm guessing that that's the philosophy you share as well.
Yes, in many respects, I do. Her description of herself as a catalyst for change is not only something I try to live by, but I try to inspire my students at Brooklyn College, my two daughters, their friends, that these are also words to live by, to see yourself as a change agent and to involve other people in changing the society for the better.
And how do you think you've changed the society?
Well, one, I was part of what I believe, and I'm writing about it, the most important social protest movement of the 20th, 21st century. That is the Women's Liberation Movement. It is one of the largest and most long-lasting movements in U.S. history and actually globally as well. In the United States today, there isn't as large a women's movement, but there's a huge women's movement in India, for example. In Africa, there are really large women's movements.
All outgrowths from what happened here?
I don't think it's necessarily outgrowths from what happened here, but clearly what happened in the United States and then in England and France and Italy and Germany inspired countries, shall we say, in the global South. And I've attended conferences in Africa, for example, where some of the debates that took place among 3,000 African women sounded like many of the debates we had 20 or 30 years ago. But they've taken their own identity and their own the issues that are important for them, because, of course, they're countries that are different than the United States.
Sure.
And the social relationships are different.
So when you were growing up, when you were at school in Washington State, was it just being at the right place at the right time, just being primed for this? Had you much thought about women and opportunity?
In the summer of 1963, I read Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, and that's one of the books that changed my life. It was not about me. It was about my mother, who was an upper-middle-class white woman, graduate of Wellesley, and married a corporate executive, and she became, quote, a corporate wife. And she had to stifle her ambitions. She wanted to go into the Foreign Service. She wanted to run for political office. And instead, she did all her civic activism as
a volunteer. Mm-hmm.
She was and when I say she was a civic activist, she was at one point the mayor of my town.
Was that a volunteer job?
Yes, it was. It was an affluent town, so you know, probably if it was a paid job, no one would take it. But she was, for example, the president of Wellesley in Westchester. She was president of the Westchester League of Women Voters. In 1955, she was one of the instrumental figures in a campaign called Personal Permanent Registration. And there are probably only about 20 people on this planet who've ever heard of PPR, and they're all members of the League of Women Voters who were over 70. But this was a campaign to enable people to register. And then once you registered, you didn't have to go back every year to register. And in fact, she worked so tirelessly in this that the New Yorker profiled her in an article called They Darn Near Killed Luella. And I didn't find this out until I was in my 50s, and I looked up. And to read a magazine article about a mother who you really did not know, I mean,
that's
I was
crazy.
So young.
Oh, my God.
It was so interesting. But she was a really tireless civic activist, but it was all volunteer.
Did you ever get a sense from her that that didn't sit well with her? Was she resentful?
She was an alcoholic. Oh. And I think that she channeled her resentment in a destructive way.
Okay.
And no, she never would discuss it. She always said, my role models were my father and my grandfather. But to me, my role model, good and bad, was my mother.
And she had your father's blessing to do all this
Absolutely.
Work?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. But she had to be home at 7 o'clock for dinner. Mm-hmm. And I think that she wanted to go to meetings. She wanted to be able to use her extraordinary talents, as befits a Wellesley graduate, she
for
would
sure.
say. And, she was stifled.
So here you are, you're reading Betty Friedan's book, and you're thinking, oh, my God, this is my mother.
And it helped me understand my mother better.
Did she read that book?
I don't know.
Okay. But you didn't encourage her to read that book.
We had a contentious relationship
okay.
until many years later. And I think my guess is, because she had a very close friend who wrote for The New Yorker, not the article about my mother, who didn't like the book and was critical of her and so forth. And I don't think my mother was ready to read Friedan mm-hmm. until probably she was in her 70s.
Okay, so you read this book. Then what happens to you?
I go away to college, mm-hmm. and I remember I was my junior year abroad, and I went to a college in Leeds, England, and all the professors were Marxists. And you learned about the woman question, and I was engaged to be married, and I wrote my fiancé, I said, what is this woman question? And he was very sympathetic, and he gave me things to read. So that got me interested. But what happened really to me was, along with sort of like my mother's influences, which I never really thought about, two events really did begin to change my life. One was right after I got married in 1967, my husband and I noticed a lump on my right breast, and we went to the doctor. And he, explained what they did. And he said, what we do is we will do a
lumpectomy, a biopsy.
A biopsy. And then he said, if it's benign, we sew you up. And in those days, you got to spend 2 nights in the hospital.
As opposed to 20 minutes.
Right, exactly. and he said, but if it's malignant, he more or less said, we have to rip out your whole right side. And so, remember, I'm 20 years old. What do I know about anything? You're told to trust doctors. They know everything. They're God. So we said, makes sense. And I'm a real sort of, I've got a problem. You solve it. You move on. It, it was scary sense. And then he handed the permission paper to my husband. And we both sort of went, what? And he said, and these were his exact words. He said, because women are too irrationally and emotionally tied to their breasts, fathers or husbands make the decision.
Oh, my God.
Not that men aren't irrationally or emotionally attached to certain parts of their organs, which wives don't have to. But, I mean, that really was transformative for me. And then also at the same – and it was benign, thank goodness. And then
that almost takes a back seat, to that experience of being with that doctor.
Well,
I mean, forgot to ask you.
The law changed 2 years later as a result of the women's movement. The idea – that your father or your husband, regardless of what they think of you, can sign over. And it's the only medical procedure they could sign over. So, I mean, it's not like you had to have your husband's permission to have a nose job or that sort of thing. And so at the same time, I decided to apply to graduate school in history. I knew I wanted to be a history professor. And I went into the graduate office, and I wanted to apply for what was called then a National Defense Education Authorization Grant. My husband had one. Now, for your listeners who are younger than me, and I hope there are millions of them, in the 50s and 60s, especially after Sputnik, the Defense Department paid for education and was extremely generous. There was a real belief that graduate education was important. And my former husband, for example, had what was called an NDEA grant. It was not a loan, and it lasted 4 years. It paid tuition, books. The first year he got $5,000, the next year he got $7,000, the next year he got $9,000, the next year he got $11,000. And that was in 1968, so you could probably triple or quadruple what it was. So, and it was very prestigious. It was as prestigious as a Fulbright, for example. Mm-hmm. So, or a Woodrow Wilson, and I don't know if they give those anymore. So I go into the graduate office to apply, and they said, "Barbara, we're not supporting any women for NDEAs this year." And I go, "Why not?" And she said, "Because the war in Vietnam, we want to keep men from, you know, having to
drafted, right."
So here I am. I'm against the war. I don't think men should be drafted. I don't think anybody should be drafted. But I am not more or less eligible for a very prestigious and financially generous scholarship or grant just because I'm a woman. So those two things took place. And then that fall, the SDS chapter, Students for a Democratic Society chapter, had a forum called The Woman Question. And a woman named Clara Frazier spoke. And she was speaking about Betty Friedan. And I went, and that was sort of it for me. And to now take a little step back, what made Seattle different from other cities, and I'm writing a book about this, was that the origins of the women's liberation movement in Seattle, or the original organizers, came mainly from what we call the old left, meaning people who had been involved in Communist Party or Trotskyist organizations prior to 1945. And Clara Frazier was a member of a very little tiny Trotskyist group, but one which was very committed to feminism. And they called a meeting, and half the women who were at the meeting were from this Trotskyist group, and the other half were women like myself.
Mm-hmm.
You might, you know, non-red diaper baby.
Kind of.
Or people whose parents were not involved in old left organizations.
Right, right, right.
And so these two different groups formed one of the first women's liberation groups in the country called Seattle Radical Women. And then, as what happens whenever you have a lot of Trotskyists in a group, or whether members of the Communist Party or you name it, I'm not blaming Trotskyists, is that there was a split in the group. And then a group of mainly left, new left women formed Women's Liberation Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
But both those groups were extremely important in the first 3 years of the women's movement in Seattle. And what also made Seattle different is the National Organization for Women is not founded in Seattle until August 1970. So already sort of like certain foundations had been laid.
Before them.
Exactly.
And so you were very involved.
Yes.
And was it at that point also that you said, this is what I want to get involved with professionally?
Well, two things happened. One, I was a history major.
Right.
And I get involved in the women's movement. And I had an English professor.
And there's no history.
Actually, there was. You just had to find it. I took a course on 20th century England, and I had a wonderful professor. I adored him. And we had a book called The Strange Death of Liberal England. And it's all about the upheavals in England prior to the First World War. And a third of the book is about the English suffragettes.
Hmm.
And I read that book and I fell in love with them. I mean, these were women who broke every window in the West End of London to get the vote. They chained themselves to Parliament. They one suffragette debutante, when she met the king and curtsied, she said, "Votes for women." And, you know, to try to echo Maggie Smith, it's sort of, "My dear, that is just not done."
Uh-huh.
So I just loved these women.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was both my activism and my interest in the academy sort of came around to look at the struggles of women.
Because you, in this time, you helped start the Women's Studies Department at your school.
Well, right. And there weren't courses on women. And in fact, I was in a graduate seminar about the Progressive Era, which is a period in U.S. history, let's say 1900 to the out, when the United States gets involved in the First World War, where a lot of reforms take place. And if any era in the United States is one in which women and gender were in the forefront, it is this period. It's the height of the struggle for women's suffrage. It's also the period of the work of Jane Addams, Hull House. Mm-hmm. Women are organizing into unions, protective legislation. And in fact, a great deal of the Progressive Era, the progressives called it social housekeeping. That is, using the government to clean up dirty streets and provide sanitation and decent housing and parks and daycare and so forth. And I remember in this seminar, this one pompous jerk was going on and on about what a great democracy America was. And I remember I looked up and I said, how can you say that? Women couldn't vote and black men in the South couldn't vote. And he literally looked at me and goes, what does that have to do with anything?
Then did you hit him?
No, I couldn't. And my professor just sort of puffed on his pipe. And I wasn't alone. Any of the students who were involved in the women's movement, what we went through was mild. A friend of mine, Naomi Weistein, who was at Radcliffe, was not allowed to study in the Harvard Library. And the reason was women would be a distraction. So Naomi and her women friends, who had a rock and roll band, played their music
outside the library.
Excellent. And they said, this is a distraction.
That's fabulous.
So, I mean, that's the kind of things we did.
Did you ever think about going into politics?
No. I mean, not electoral Democratic and Republican politics.
I mean, too.
No, never.
Rather affect change academically.
No, and also in terms of political organizing grassroots level. I mean, I was involved in Washington State's struggle for abortion reform. Washington State was the first state to liberalize its abortion laws through a referendum, and our Women's Liberation Group was very much involved.
Right.
In that.
I didn't mean to infer that you were there was no activism. I just meant, did you ever think that you could affect change in another way?
No.
Let's get us to Brooklyn. You joined the faculty in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
That was a goal of yours, wasn't it, to get involved with the Women's Studies program, correct?
I mean, well, I had been teaching Women's Studies
since
1971. And I also was very committed to teaching at public institutions and especially for underserved communities. I taught 10 years at Cuyahoga Community College. And I'm still a Cleveland Indians fan. But as opposed to teaching at an Oberlin or a private
Harvard
institution.
Or Harvard, where you can't go to the library.
Right. Well, I would never get hired at Harvard. So when I moved to New York, I spent the first 10 years adjuncting at all sorts of different places.
Right.
Then I taught for 3.5 years at Medgar Evers College. And then I was asked to join the Brooklyn College faculty, and originally I was asked to join specifically to save the Women's Studies program, which was in a lot of trouble.
Did you?
Well, I didn't save it by myself, but I...
Was it resurrected?
In a sense. We were able to get a lot of money from donors and from grants, and the program is very... It's probably one of the most visible programs on the Brooklyn College campus. And it has involved a whole new generation of faculty. So it's a very thriving program, and I played a role in doing
that. So let's move to Shirley Chisholm. On the one hand, this project seems like a no-brainer because Shirley Chisholm went to Brooklyn College. She lived in Brooklyn. She represented the 12th Congressional District. She's a symbol of liberal politics, an educator, and on and on and on. Having said all that, how did the two of you coalesce, the project and you?
Well, I was on a sabbatical in 2005, and I was trying to think of what I was going to do with myself because I didn't just want to write academic books that maybe 4 or 5 people
would read. Right.
And my mother had died, so she wouldn't even read them. So, and then I have a colleague and friend named Julie Gallagher who was writing a book about African-American women in New York City politics, and she taught at Antioch College, and we became friends, and one time she was telling me about her work, and it hit me. Shirley Chisholm went to Brooklyn College. Oh, my gosh. And I was asking Julie where she went to find the resources, and she said, they're really hard to find. And then I came up with this scheme of this idea is, why don't I interview people who knew Shirley Chisholm?
Right, 2005, if I may interrupt, is when Shirley Chisholm died.
That's right. And what had happened is we had created the Shirley Chisholm Center for Research in part of the Women's Studies program, and I actually got a chance to speak to her, even though it was right before she died, and I promised her that this center would be more than worthy of her name. And she was going to come up to Brooklyn and be there for the inauguration of the center.
Because at that
point, she lived
in Florida, right?
Yes, she lived outside of Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
I'd come up with the idea of the project even when she was alive. But at first, the idea of the project was to find other manuscripts, documents, artifacts about Chisholm to put in the library, and then to interview people who knew her. And then it sort of took a life of its own, and I started working with people and having public events about Shirley Chisholm. And then right after she died, Nick Perry, who's a senator in Albany, was able to get Pataki to make November 30th.
Former governor of New York.
November 30th, which is Shirley Chisholm's birthday, Shirley Chisholm Day. So the project then would host a big event. So, for example, in 08, Gloria Steinem came and spoke. And this was right after the Obama election. We were just so glad he won. We would have said it would have been such
awkward.
A bummer.
It would have been very awkward.
But we've had Donna Brazile speak. We've had Anita Hill. We've had Loretta Ross, who was a very important activist in the reproductive rights movement and women of color. And Shirley Chisholm got Loretta Ross involved. And we always have elected officials come. It's a big event that we host.
And you draw from your student body.
The student body comes and the community comes. So it's a way to bring to have our students meet the community get to know Brooklyn College better.
You also said that you're writing a biography. You met her.
I met her, when I say met her, I met her really briefly when she campaigned in 72 in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it was sort of like, hello.
Okay.
That's all.
What's the focus of this biography?
My book was originally titled, and they had to change it, Shirley Chisholm, Urban Liberalism, Feminism, and the Black Freedom Struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And this book basically talks about Chisholm and urban liberalism and feminism. So it really discusses her life in sort of like why she became such a why she was so radical, why she stayed in the Democratic Party as opposed to doing what other people did. To point out that she, in order for her to be the kind of political activist she was, she felt she had to stay in the Democratic Party, which meant making compromises or not making compromises. The other interesting thing is she has another very famous quote, which goes about, she talks about how of the two sort of challenges she faced, race and gender, the most difficult was being a woman. And a lot of people have sort of, especially African-American academics, don't like that concept, sort of like it should be more intertwined. But if you follow her story, the people who disappointed her the most were basically African-American men. And every one of the men who worked for Chisholm, who I've interviewed, have said the same thing. I mean, she was treated terribly by black men. So I raise that in the book as well.
So do you teach about her in your courses?
My students all laugh at me because they think every other sentence that comes out of my mouth is Shirley Chisholm.
Mm-hmm.
In a course I teach on the history of feminism, they read the speech she gives when she's announcing her presidential run, and they read her piece on why she supports abortion. Because as an African-American woman, she was, in the 70s, one of the leading spokespersons for a woman's right to abortion and to contraception. And she challenged the black nationalists who were all against it. So, yes, she's part of the curriculum. She's part of the curriculum now in all our intro courses. And the one thing I will say is I think I've brought at least name recognition back about Shirley Chisholm to our students. When I first suggested we name our research center after Shirley Chisholm, half the faculty did not know who she was.
Even in Brooklyn.
Even in Brooklyn, because if you're under 55 or 60, she was out of Brooklyn for 20 years or mm-hmm. 30 years, and she's not written into the history books. She's just being sort of written about now.
So then the point is that women and women of color are not in today's society attributing anything to her?
No, it's not that black women aren't attributing anything to her. It's there's now a new generation of women who are writing about black women in the black freedom struggle. Another colleague of mine at Brooklyn College, Jean Theo Harris, wrote this wonderful book about Rosa Parks.
Mm-hmm.
Another,
but everybody knows her.
Except they only know her as the tired seamstress who
sat on the bus.
They don't know that she was an activist her entire life. And in fact, this book is so important. Charles Blow wrote a whole New York Times editorial about it. And Jean has been all over the country speaking about it. And it's a very important story because there are two women who were very important. One is, of course, Rosa Parks, who was the tired seamstress. And then the other is Coretta Scott King, who's just the grieving widow.
Right.
And she was an activist all her life. And then Chisholm was more or less just written out of, or not written out. She just was
never included.
Because, and I think it's much more the African-American male politicians who just wouldn't have anything to do with her. And it still continues. When Barack Obama was running in 08 in the primary against Hillary Clinton, I tried to write editorials about, op-ed pieces about Chisholm to point out that, no, it's not white women versus black men. It's far more complicated. But the press wanted the narrative of white women against black men and then the historic first of a black man and just couldn't get it done.
And wasn't sexy enough, was it?
And even Jesse Jackson, he would get interviewed and he would talk about how he was the first person to run and how he paved the way for Barack Obama. And the last time I heard him being interviewed, he actually said, "I see myself as a catalyst for change." And he used Chisholm's exact words and didn't cite her.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a deliberate erasure.
Yeah, an exclusion. To switch gears just slightly, what do you think of the state of feminism today versus politics? Do you feel buoyed by your female students? Are you encouraged?
The fact that I get to teach these working class, immigrant students in a women's studies class, for me, is they bring their personal stories to the class I teach. And I'm now older than many of their grandmothers.
But you look good.
Well, and there's no Botox. But it is really great because they then take sort of the basic text they have to read and translate it into their lives. Now, the students in the Women's Studies program, I would say 95% of them tend to continue, whether it's academic activism or political activism. A number of my students end up working for the project. We're actually setting up the Shirley Chisholm Leadership internship program. We're going to raise money to involve 15 women students a year in an internship program where they will work with community groups, political activist groups, and so forth. So we take our role as training the next generation of feminists. They're going to define the feminism as it affects their lives and how they see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the best example I can give is when I was a student at the University of Washington, and I was very interested in the women's suffrage movement, and I actually met and interviewed women who had been suffragists in Washington State. And they would sort of say to me, "You just don't appreciate what we did for you." And they were right.
Mm-hmm.
Because for my generation, the issue of the vote was not the most important issue. Because in one sense, we saw the world change as a result of mass demonstrations and activism and not necessarily voting. And I think for my generation, much of the life and death issue for us was control of our bodies, reproductive freedom.
Right.
So I hear a lot of women of my generation saying about the next generation, they just don't appreciate what we've done for them. And I look at them and I go, "You're right." And they're not going to, because at least in New York State, abortion is legal. You can get contraception. That's not the
most. We have to move on.
Right. The cutting edge for them may be violence, you know, gendered violence. It may be LGBTQ equality, or it may be workplace issues that we.
Like pay equality.
Pay
equality,
sexual harassment on the job, you know, access and so forth.
Not opportunity, a lack of opportunity.
And the issue of race and ethnicity is far more in front in their minds than it was for a lot of the white women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's very important. So I love being at Brooklyn College, and I'm really very proud of our women's studies program because the courses we teach deal with the reality of our students' lives. I've seen some of the women's studies programs in other places, and it's so theoretical. It just, to me, it's sort of like, what is the point of even studying this?
Mm-hmm.
I don't particularly care.
Mm-hmm.
It has no relationship to women in the world of work, women who are having to deal with both work and motherhood, even women like myself, older women, who have to deal with the political implications of aging and so forth. So we have I'm very proud of it. And most of the women's studies programs at the City University of New York are very much like that as well.
Barbara, it was a real pleasure to meet you.
Well, this was really fun, and I really am pleased that you invited me. I'm very flattered.
Join us for another episode of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. And if you'd like to reach the 51%, contact us at advertising@51percentconversations.com.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.